हेलो फ्रेंड्स, द नेक्स्ट टॉपिक 18th सेंचुरी प्रोज इंट्रोडक्शन। द 18th सेंचुरी वॉज अ ग्रेट पीरियड फॉर इंग्लिश प्रोज द नॉट फॉर इंग्लिश पोएट्री। मैथ्यू अर्नॉल्ड कॉल्ड इट एन एज ऑफ प्रोज एंड रीजन, एम्प्लाइंग देयर बाय दैट नो गुड पोएट्री वॉज रिटन इन दिस सेंचुरी एंड दैट प्रोज डोमिनेटेड द लिटरेरी रीम। मच ऑफ द पोएट्री ऑफ द एज इज प्रोजाइक, if not altogether prose, rhymed prose verse was used by many poets of the age for purpose which could be realized or realized better through prose. Our view is that the 18th century was not altogether barren of real poetry. Even then, it is better known for the galaxy of brilliant prose writer that it threw up. In this century, there was a remarkable proliferation of practical interest, which could rest be expressed in a new kind of prose, pliant and of a work a day kind, capable of rising to every occasion. This prose was simple and modern, having nothing of the baroque or Ciceronian color of the prose of the 17th century writer like Milton and Thomas Brown. Practicality and reason ruled supreme in prose and determined its style. It is really strange that in this period the language of prose was becoming simpler and more easily comprehensible, but on the other hand the language of poetry was being conventionalized into that artificial poetic diction which at the end of century was so severely condemned by Wordsworth as giddy and inane phraseology. The contribution of ease to prose. Much of 18th century prose is taken up by topical journalistic issue, as indeed is the prose of any other age. However, in 18th century we come across for the first time in the history of English literature a real huge mass of pamphlets, journals, booklets and magazines. The whole activity of life of the 18th century is embodied in the works of literary critic, economists, literary writers, essayists, politicians, public speakers, divines, philosophers, historians, scientists, biographers, and public projectors. Moreover, a thing of particular importance is the introduction of two new prose genres in this century. The novel and the periodical paper are the two gifts of the century to English literature. The sum of the best prose of the age is to be found in its novel and periodical essays summing up the importance of century, or these words of a critic in inverted comma. The 18th century by itself had created the novel and practically created the literary history. It had put the essay into general circulation. It had hit of various forms and abundant supply of literary works. It had added largely to philosophy and literature. Above all, it had sapped the form of English prose of all work, the one thing that remained to be done at its opening. When an age has done so much, it seems somewhat liberal to reproach it with not doing more. Even Matthew Arnold had been called the 18th century our excellent and indispensable 18th century. Don't come out closed. After these preliminary consideration, let us briefly discuss the important trends and writers of the age. Daniel Defoe, 1660 to 1731. Defoe was perhaps the most copious writer of the 18th century. He is best known for his Robinson Crusoe and some other works of fiction like Moll Flander and Roxana. His non-fictive prose consists of a large number of pamphlets, generally published anonymously, and a staggering bulk of miscellaneous writing, mostly topical in nature. He started a tri-weekly periodical, The Review of 1704, which continued up to 1713. In it, he dealt with political, religious, commercial matters. There is not much of the universal in his non-fictive prose to keep it alive, but not just wonders at the sheer number of his works, which total above 500. John Arbuthnot, 1661 to 1735. Arbuthnot, a man estimable for his learning, amiable for his life, and venerable for his pity, was a close associate of Swift and Pope and was by profession a physician. His History of John Bull, 1712, an allegorical satire in the word of Lewis in a short history of English literature, remains one of the most famous political satire England has produced. Therein described the legal battle between John Bull and Nick Frog, Holland, on the one side the Lewis Baboon, France, and the Lord Sut, Spain, on the other. Arbuthnot uphold evidently the Tory point of view, favoring the termination of hostilities, then raging between the countries mentioned above. The manifest Anne is the master of lucid and Ovid style, as also delightful stroke of irony, which made Swift complain. Arbuthnot is no more, my friend, who dares to irony pretend, which I was born in introduce, refined it first and should it use. Jonathan Swift, 1667-1745. Swift was the greatest prose satirist of England. He dominated the first half of the 18th century and Dr. Johnson did the second, and as an intellectual he was far superior to Johnson. Some of his satires are absence misanthropic and cynical, but none can question his more integrity and unflinching earnestness which he removed the external of thing to bring out the corruption which lies at their heart. Swift's satire is all-embracing. It's a rapier-like thrust, spare neither a fraudulent almanac maker, nor a misguised zealot, nor an airy philosopher, nor a glib politician, nor a conceit pop, nor a pretentious scientist. This greatest of satirists once satired even satire. The paltry partridge, PRTRIDGE, an almanac maker, and the great Walpole, the Prime Minister of England, alike winced under the terrible whip of scorpions. Swift's sensitiveness to all corruption, the numerous frustration which punctuated the entire span of his life, and the egregious folly, corruption, and self-seeking which he found tainting the age of reason, the good sense, prompted him to take up his last, the age deserved satire, and his personal disposition and disappointment made him keen enough to give it Swift's perfectly right when he says in the death of Dean Swift, "Perhaps I may allow the Dean had too much satire in his vein, and seemed determined not to strive it, because no eyes could more deserve it." The greatness of Swift's satire is, in the last analysis, a triumph of technique. His arsenal as a satirist is chock full of weapons of all description: wit, raillery, sarcasm, irony, allegory, and so many more weapons are used to perfection by him in his crusade against folly, injustice, and unreason. Whichever weapon may he be employing for attack, his satire is usually darker and more telling than that of most writer. He may sometimes touch lightly, but very often he presses deep to the very heart of life. In any case, his satire is very disturbing, as it present thing in a fairly conventional perspective, eminently calculated to setter of complacency of the reader. When Swift point out the required follies, he is quite constructive, but when he satires the very nature of man, he is nothing but destructive. Of all the satiric technique, the one most effectively used by Swift is irony. With Swift, irony is often much more than just a figure of a speech. It is extended so that the entire range of thought and feeling presented in satiric work seems to be coming not for Swift himself, but for a fictive character, a persona created for the prose. The irony lies in the difference between the views expressed by the persona and the common sense view, the view of the Swift himself. Swift wrote a very large number of satires of which the most important, the Battle of the Books, the Tale of Tub and the Gulliver's Travel. The first is just a geodesprit and was meant to lampoon and mock heroic Tom and the opponent of his patron, Sir William Temple, particularly Richard Bentley and William Wotton, both of whom had disputed the view of Temple granting supremacy of the ancients over the moderns. A Tale of a Tub was means to be a satire on the numerous and the gross corruption in religion and learning. It represented the Church of England as the best of all churches in doctrine and discipline, and also lashed the shallow writers and critics of the age. Gulliver's Travel is the most famous of Swift's works. In it, he savagely indicated the animal called man. Though it has the external of a travel romance, at in reality, it is a terrible but well-calculated satire on all the activities of human life and all the attributes of human nature, not sparing even the human body. However, its irony is so deep that it has been a favorite gift book for children. Clipping once said that Swift ignited in a volcano to light a child to bed. In fact, the book is enjoyed by all children from 9 to 90. Credit must be given to Swift for the clarity, precision, and what Herbert Davis called the conciseness of his prose style. Swift dispenses all unnecessary ornament. His imagery, however, is prolific and concrete. At any rate, he gives us the impression of any easy mastery of language. Halliday, in the introduction of his selection from Swift's, observe the various phases of scorn and satire, of appraisement, the direct denunciation, the various mood and the temper of the writer, and the expressed with wonderful and insatiable skill the strength of his power over his reader is to be sought for her. He make you responsive to every nuance, the thought and emotion, and draw you with the magic of his a pipe into whatever region he desires. Addition is still in the periodical issue. From Swift to addition is like coming from a reel to a paper tiger. Addison perfected the periodical essay, which was invented by the Steele with the Tatler in 1709. Addison collaborated with Steele as Steele did with him in The Spectator, which was launched by Addison in 1711 after the Tatler had been wound up. The periodical paper was extremely suited to the temper of condition of the 18th century, and that explained it in immense popularity. The genius of Addison was also quite happy with this new literary genre. He wrote a few more work, but his popularity today is entirely due to his work as a periodical essayist. The work of Addison and Steele as periodical essayist was actuated by a definite purpose, that of providing instructive amusement to their readers, many of whom were women. "I must confess," wrote Addison once, "where I left to myself, I would rather aim at instructing than diverting." But instruction would not have been welcomed by the readers if it were without some diversion. As instructor, Addison and Steele paid special attention to improving the moral and social manner of the people. As champions of good taste and reason, they did their best to improve the tone of society. They also popularized philosophy with this paper and Paradise Lost and the Old Ballad of Chevy Chase. Addison did a signal service to literary criticism. Steele and Addison are mostly retailers of other men's opinion. They were not philosophers themselves, but they did substantial work of make philosophy a subject of popular appreciation and discussion. Addison's prose style is as lucid and precise and Swift's, but it has much more of polish, refinement, and studied edge. Dr. Johnson called his style the model of the middle style, and this is his famous advice in inverted comma. "However, wishes to attain an English style familiar but not coarse, and elegant but not ostentatious, must give his days and nights to the volumes of addition. Still, as a man of a stylist was less refined and consistent than addition. He is sometimes patently ungrammatical, even then sometimes his style in all its spontaneity and attending carelessness speaks at it where from the core of his heart as additions never even seems to do. I like said Le Hunt still with all his faults better than Addison with all his issues. Philosopher and theologian George Berkeley 1685 to 1753 and David Hume 1711 to 76 were the great philosopher of the 18th century has hopes and locks and had been of the 17th. Berkeley was an upholder of absolute idealism and as such went so far as to deny the very existence of matter. His deep religious conviction had the color of mysticism. As regard the clarity of Berkeley's prose style, Lewis observed in noted comma, nothing could be more admirable than the lucid prose, perfectly simple and perfectly elegant, in which Berkeley expressed his profound and subtle views. Hume was by far a greatest philosopher of his age. His approach is marked by scepticism and utilitarianism. Regarding his style, Lewis says, in noted comma, nothing could be more tranquil and assured than the march of his thought, nothing clearer than the prose in which he pursued his most subtle analysis in lucid and sober language. Adam Smith, 1723-19, was the father of political economy, which Ruskin and his ilk were to attack in the Victorian age. His Wealth of Nations, 1776, to enjoy a long and undisputed reign as the Bible of political economists. His style is precious and unadorned to the extent of being altogether sapless. The first half of the 18th century saw the furious ragging of the deistic controversy. The deists, including Charles Blount, John Tallant, Matthew Tyndall, Anthony Collins, and the Earl of Shaftesbury, believed in what they called natural religion. That is, belief in God without corresponding belief in Christianity, or as a matter of fact, any religion shift was one of those who controverted the deistic heresy. The rise of Methodism was another theological feature of the century. The two Wesley brothers, John and Charles, were the initiator of the new move toward importing the old enthusiasm, simplicity, and sincerity into the religion of the day. John Wesley's prose is characterized by directions, simplicity, and a rude complaining force. Dr. Johnson, 1709-84. As a prose writer, Dr. Johnson is particularly known for his dictionary, his periodical paper, his philosophical tale, Rasselas, and his critical work, Lives of the Poets. He was the champ of the realm of the letters in his age and an accepted arbiter of taste. As a critic, he made many egregious errors, but his infectious sanity cannot be ignored. As a prose stylist, he was a purist. However, his style, though vigorous and direct, is somewhat heavy-handed, and as such is sometimes derisively called Johnsonist. Which Chambers Dictionary define a Johnsonian style, idiom, diction, or an imitation of it, ponderous English, full of antitheses, balanced traits, and words of classical origin. Goldsmith said jokingly about Johnson's style that it may fit the mouth of Wallace, but it certainly does not fit the mouth of Little Fish. Biographers and later writers. The 18th century produced a number of biographers, autobiographers, and writers of semi-public letters. James Boswell, 1714-95, the biographer of his ideal Dr. Johnson, has the pride of place among them. His work is as massive as the great Johnson himself. Life of Johnson is a new, unique work of its kind. Boswell's devotion to Dr. Johnson became the cause of his own fame. Among the autobiographers, may be mentioned Zebon, Lord Harvey and John Wesley. Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, Cowper, Chesterfield, Gilbert White, Gray and Horace Walpole were some of the famous later writers of the 18th century. Periodical paper and Oliver Goldsmith, 1713-74. After the Spectator, there was a remarkable proliferation of periodical literature in England. To name all the periodical papers which appeared in the 18th century will be an uphill task as their number is legion. Most of them continued the tradition set by Addison and Steele. The name of Oliver Goldsmith is associated with numerous periodical papers. His cosmopolitan attitude, tolerance, delicacy, and sentiment are his hallmark as an essayist. He expressed himself in a chaste and elegant style, free from artificial devices. Historians. The 18th century was the establishment of historiography as a respectable and highly developed branch of the learned activity. Edward Gibbon, 1737-94, writer of the monumental The Decline and Fall of a Roman Empire, was the greatest of the historiographer of the age. His attitude is entirely rational and anti-mystical. His style is dignified and somewhat procedural, but he can effectively combine harmony and majesty with logic and precision. Edmund Brooke, 1729-97. Brooke was the greatest orator of the age. He dealt with the pressing political problem facing the British Empire. His works concerning Indian and American affairs and French Revolution are couched in brilliant and rhetorical prose which cannot but impress the most indifferent reader or listener. He was an anti-theorist who recommended action in keeping with the spirit and complexion of the times. The topic, 18th century prose, over.